Is it Mary, who we'll read about next week? A lot of times we think it's the Apostle Peter, you know, because Peter falls on his face so spectacularly and yet also does some great things. And we can relate to that because we too fall on our face. Is it James and John, the sons of thunder, the disciples of Jesus, who are always ready to say, "Let's get this, Jesus. Let's go." Who is it? Well, this week, for me, it was Zechariah. Because he's supposed to have all the answers. Right? He's the priest that stands before the people and ministers for the people. He's supposed to have all the answers. He's supposed to not just have enough faith for himself, but also enough faith for his people as he ministers for them. But when God meets Zechariah, when God tells him, "All right, I'm about to answer your prayers. I'm about to do exactly what you've been asking me to do for so long." What does Zechariah do? He doubts. He doesn't believe. That's what the angel said. This is going to happen. You'll be mute because you did not believe my words. And instead, he asks questions. He goes, "This can't happen. This is impossible. How can this be? There's no way. Don't look at the circumstances. This physically, biologically, all of that. This can't happen." And that's where I find myself so many times: questioning, doubting, struggling. And here, right at the beginning, Luke is saying, "I am writing this story for people like Zechariah. I'm writing this story, this history of the life and ministry and death, the resurrection of Jesus for doubters, for people like Zechariah." And so I want us to think about this beginning of the Gospel of Luke like that. Who does Luke write for? What kinds of people is the Gospel of Luke, Jesus according to Luke, who is that for? So, three types of people. First, Luke is for doubters like Zechariah. And he wants to say to all of us doubters out there, it's all true. It's all true. He doesn't just write for Zechariah. Look at the verse 4 verses. He says he's actually writing this for a person named Most Excellent. That's a title. And his name was Theophilus, lover of God. Okay? We don't know much about this Theophilus. He's probably a new Christian. Maybe he's a student of Luke's because he says he's writing to him to give him confidence in these things that you have been taught. So maybe Luke was teaching them to him. We just don't know. Okay, but what we do know about him is all these things that he's been taught about Jesus, about what Jesus has done, about who Jesus is, about what those things mean for him. He's just not sure about them. He's not certain. He's not confident. They're doubts. Right? That's why Luke says he's writing this for him, is to give him assurance, confidence, certainty. And so right up front, Luke is saying, "I'm writing this for doubters like Theophilus, like Zechariah, who has an angel appear to him." You ever think that? What would make you have certainty? Well, if an angel appeared right next to a table that I was serving something at, I would believe. Not Zechariah. Or maybe you're like Thomas. You're thinking, if I could just stick my fingers in the holes of Jesus' side and his hands and his feet, I'd believe, right? But the gospel is full of doubters, of people who struggled to believe. And Luke is writing to them and he's saying, it's all true. It's history. He's saying, this really happened. No, really. This happened. When we read about paralytics being healed, it happened. When we read about people being possessed by demons and Jesus casting them out, it really happened. When we read about Jesus feeding the 5,000 with just a couple of loaves of bread, it really happened. How can we get to the place? How can we believe that Luke is really writing stuff that really happened? He tells us how he writes his story. He says a couple of things. One, he says, I followed these things. I investigated them very carefully. Look at verse 3. It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write. He's taken a long and careful look at the Jesus story. Who's Luke? Luke is a companion of the Apostle Paul. He's a Gentile, and he's a dog. He meets the Apostle Paul, I think, on his second journey out to share the gospel in places beyond the promised land, beyond Israel. And Luke becomes one of his traveling companions as he goes from town to town, the Apostle Paul sharing the message of Jesus. And then on his third missionary journey, when the Apostle Paul is headed back to Jerusalem, Luke goes with Paul back to Jerusalem. And he spends over 2 years in Jerusalem, where he's able to visit Calvary, the place of the cross, where he's able to walk the streets of Jerusalem, where he's able to visit the temple and see where Jesus ministered, where he's able to go to the Garden of Gethsemane and see where Jesus prayed on the last night of his life, where he's able to go to Bethlehem, where Jesus is born, where he's able to travel probably to Galilee, to the area where Jesus did most of his ministry, around the Sea of Galilee. So he's seen the storms that come up there. So he's done all this research. He's walked in and around all the places where Jesus was. He's probably seen the empty tomb, etc., etc. Secondly, he tells us that he talked to eyewitnesses. He says, verse 2, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered to them to us. So he's spoken to these who were eyewitnesses and ministers to these things. So he would have talked to lots of people. So if you want to know, if you weren't at an event and you hear that something's happened and you want to know what really happened, what would you do? Well, it seems like these days we just watch somebody's cell phone video, right? But if you wanted to really find out, you would go and you would talk to lots of different people who were there. And that's what Luke says he did. Probably he talked to Mary, the mother of Jesus, who says about all these things that happened that she treasured them up in her heart. Probably she's the one that shared the story of Elizabeth and Zechariah. He's talked to James, Jesus's brother, and heard about what Jesus was like growing up with. He's talked to those whom Jesus has healed. Lepers and paralytics and demon possessed. He's heard their stories. He's talked to the people that Jesus ministered to, that experienced Jesus' kindness and acceptance, like tax collectors, like Levi, and prostitutes. Maybe he even talked to the centurion who stood at the foot of the cross looking up at Jesus and watching him there, said the word, surely this man was innocent. Maybe he talked to the women who went to the tomb and found it empty. He does his research. He looks, he talks to all these people, including the apostles who had a special access to Jesus, because so many times Jesus took the apostles away, just the 12 of them with Jesus. And they heard his stories over and over again and the explanations of them. And Luke goes and he talks to them and he hears it from them. He also, it seems like he has copies of what others have written. In verse 1 it says, As many others have undertaken to compile a narrative of these things that have been accomplished among us. And one of the sources we think we know that he had was the Gospel of Mark. And he sits down and he takes what he's seen and what he's heard from eyewitnesses and what he's read and other people's stories, and he researches them and puts them all together, he says, in an orderly account. Why? Because he wants you and I to know that these things are true. He says in verse 4, that you may have certainty, confidence concerning the things that you have been taught. Luke wants us to know for sure about Jesus. He wants us to have confidence. Just think about it. We live in a day and age of fake news. We live in a day and age of misinformation and never knowing if what you are reading is true or not. Right? You go out and you search the internet for something and you're like, I don't know if I can trust CNN. I don't know if I can trust Fox. I don't know if I can trust Sean Hannity. I don't know if I can trust whoever it is that you listen to and read or the other side that you listen to and read. Right? That's why we have to have fact checkers that check them. And then we have fact checkers that check the fact checkers. And then we probably have fact checkers that check the fact checkers that check the fact checkers. And Luke is saying this. I'm telling you as best as I can. As I have researched, as I have talked to people, that these things really happen, that they're true. That this is real. This is not something that happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's not a fairy tale that we get all dressed up for and go watch at the movies and remember the songs and sing them until our parents are so tired of them. It's true. It happened. It's real. That's what Luke is saying. It's all true. And for doubters out there like me, like Zechariah, like Theophilus, he's saying it's true. And so if you pray like I do, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. I believe this is true, but I'm struggling to believe it's true. Luke is for you. And so he's saying, read Luke. Read it. It's for you. This was written for you that you might know these things are true. So first, Luke is written for doubters. Second, Luke is written for the barren and the empty and the hurting. It's interesting. Luke begins his story about Jesus not with Jesus. Instead, he begins it with an old couple named Zechariah and Elizabeth. He begins not with Jesus, he begins with John the Baptist. And he begins with this old couple who are childless. They're from a priestly family. They're godly people, which means that they love God, they strive to follow God, not that they're perfect, but that they love God and they want to please God. Zechariah is a priest, which means he works at the temple part of the year, and then he ministers to the people of God in his hometown part of the year. But then Luke tells us something very intimate about them, very personal about them. He tells us about their pain. He tells us about their struggle. He says they have not been able to have children. Just think about it. They've been married for decades. No children. They've tried and they've tried and they've tried and they've tried, and yet as each month has passed, again and again, the answer is no. Maybe there were a few times when there was a joyful month when they thought the answer was yes, and then a couple of months go by, and then there's a miscarriage. Right? Luke's inviting us. He's inviting us into their pain. Right? Maybe the miscarriage is why she hides herself until she's 5 months pregnant before she tells anybody. Surely they had prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed for a child. And yet again and again and again, the answer was no. Surely they had asked their friends and their family and their church to pray for them. Maybe they had asked the other elders and priests in their town to come and lay hands on them and anoint them with oil and pray over them to have children. Likely they had fasted again and again, and yet again And again, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, the answer was no. Some of you know what that's like. All too well. And Luke begins his story right here with Zechariah and Elizabeth. And they are now at the point where they've given up hope. They're beyond the years. So Zechariah does what he does every year. He goes up to do his duty at the temple. And he goes there and he's doing his duties. And every day at the temple, one of the things that would happen twice a day was one of the priests would be chosen by lot to go into the holy place. Okay, you have the big part of the temple and you have this small part of the temple where one part of it is the holy place where the priests go in twice a day. And then there's the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant is, where the presence of God dwells amidst his people, where only one person goes once a year. And Zechariah is chosen as one of those persons that goes into the holy place to burn incense that is a symbol of the prayers of God's people that go up to God. And you're only chosen to do this once in your lifetime. So after you've done it, never again. So here's another part of Zechariah's pain, right? That he's been a priest for decades. And again, the lot comes and it's somebody else. But now it's him. He goes in to burn incense and he's in there and he's all the people outside are praying and he's inside the holy place and he's praying and I'm sure he's got butterflies in his stomach because anytime you went in there, I would assume you have butterflies in your stomach. And then all of a sudden, as if that's not enough, there's an angel that appears to him right there in front of the table. He's at the table and the angel appears to him. And if being in the holy place is not enough to scare you, that'll scare you. An angel says to him, God has heard your prayers. And he's about to take the barrenness away. And Zechariah is dumbfounded, right? He says, how can this be? I'm an old man. And Elizabeth is advanced in years. Even in those days, you couldn't say your wife was old. You had to say something like she's advanced in years, right? He says, I'm an old man. My wife is advanced in years. We're way beyond the possibility of that. We've given up on that. Even though you're standing here right before me, I can't believe this. This is impossible. And here's the thing. Zechariah has forgotten this is the way that God works. Is that God delights to come when he's about to work salvation for his people to meet them in their very barrenness, their emptiness, their hopelessness, when they're about given up and he works salvation for his people. Just think about people having a baby after they've been barren forever. Abraham and Sarah, at the very beginning of God's people in Genesis, God comes and makes this promise to Abraham when there's still hope. But then he makes Abraham wait and wait and wait until I think Abraham is like 90 years old and his wife is like 80. And then he gives him a child. And they too, when the angel said, God is going to give you a child, what did they do? She laughed at him. She doubted. But that's how God works. And then Isaac, their son that they have, he becomes of age. He marries Rebekah, and for a long time, her womb is barren until God comes and meets them. And they have Jacob. And then Jacob marries Rachel, and for a long time, she's barren until God gives them Joseph. Again and again, this is how God works. In the book of Judges, it's a dark time in the people of the history of Israel. And we come to the story of Samson, and it talks about his mom was barren for a long time until God meets and fills her and gives her life and gives her Samson. And in the book of Samuel, Hannah is barren. And year after year, she goes up to the temple praying to God, asking for a son. Finally, God gives her a son, Samuel. This is how God works again And again and again and again, when he's ready to work salvation for his people, he often takes a barren, hopeless situation and brings life. That's what he does. He meets us in our barrenness, in our need. That's what he does for Zechariah and Elizabeth and giving them John. And we said it kind of like this when we were studying the book of Ruth. We said that our barrenness, our need, is the fertile soil of God's work. It's the place where God loves to come and work for his people. The more we see our need, our barrenness, the more we need, the more we see our need for Jesus, the more we'll turn to Jesus. Think about a couple examples in the Gospel of Luke. If you want to, you can turn over to chapter 5. There's a paralytic man, and he longs to be healed. And he's trying to get to Jesus because he knows that Jesus is healing people. He's seen it. He's heard about it. He's heard his friends talk about it. And so he's desperate to get to Jesus because he needs Jesus to heal him. And so he and his friends try, and they can't because the crowds are so big. And so they're so desperate that they do what? They climb on top of the house and they destroy the roof of this house to make a hole in the roof so they can get to Jesus. You see, in their need drives them to Jesus. Or there's a leper right before that who falls on his face and begs Jesus, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And the question is, how much do we need Jesus? You know how you can tell how much you think you need Jesus is how often you run to him. Because if you don't think you need Jesus, if you don't see your barrenness, your emptiness, your need, you're not going to run to him. Or you might think you can handle it yourself. But here's Luke saying that I'm writing this story for the barren because that's who Jesus comes for. The desperate, the needy, the childless, those who are struggling, those who know they need Jesus. That's who I write for because these are the fertile soil for God's work. But here's the thing, we often forget that this is how God works, like Zechariah, who Jesus came for. And so that's the next one. He comes for the doubters, he comes for the barren. And then lastly, Luke writes for Jesus comes for the ashamed. Look at the very last verse of our text, verse 25. Elizabeth says, when she is conceived and she's pregnant with John, it says, "Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach, my shame among people." It was common, but bad theology to think like this. This is the way many in Israel thought, though it is like bad theology, that if something bad is happening to you, like barrenness, like paralysis, like blindness, that it must be because somebody has sinned against God. It's the way Job's friends thought, right? But Israel didn't learn the lesson of Job. The lesson of Job is, it's not always because of sin. Sometimes it is because of sin, but many times it is not. We don't know why this man was born this way. Like the apostles come to Jesus one time and they say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus says, neither. It was done for the glory of God. But many in Israel thought the way one of Job's friends did, who says in Job 15:34, the company of the godless is barren. And so think about Elizabeth. She's advanced in years, whatever that is. And think about all the looks and the hushed conversations and the talking behind your back that's happened over her life, where people would say things like, if she would just confess that sin, the Lord would open her womb. If she would just confess whatever it is that she's hiding, the Lord would give for them a child. And she's having to live with this, even though she hasn't earned it. This, as it were, this shame, this reproach in the midst of her people over years and years and years and years. But what Luke writes is, he says that the Lord has come to take away that reproach, that shame. This is what Jesus came to do. To take away our shame, our reproach. And the angel is saying to Zechariah and Elizabeth, get ready. Because I'm going to give you a son. And he's not going to just announce salvation just for you. This is not just about taking away your reproach. But he's going to be the one that whose job is to tell everybody, get ready. I'm about to take away the shame of all of my people. I'm about to send my son, Jesus, who's going to take away the reproach, the shame of all who believe in him. Think about this. It's been 400 years since what Robert read in Malachi chapter 4. It's been 400 years of silence from God. 400 years, no new word from God, no new message from God. And then here he comes. He's telling Zechariah and Elizabeth, I'm going to give you a son. He's going to take away your barrenness. I'm going to take away your barrenness. I'm going to take away your reproach, your shame. And he is going to be the messenger of me taking away the shame of all who would believe in him. He says it like this. In verse 14 and 15, you will have joy and gladness, for he will be great before the Lord. And he says he must not drink wine or strong drink. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. He'll be a messenger of reconciliation, that the Lord has come to take away our shame. To take away the alienation between us and God, between us and each other. And the message of John, the message of Jesus, is for us who have shame. If you're anything like me, you know that there is shame in your life. There are things that you're ashamed of. Things that you've done. Things that you've said. Things that you've thought. Things that no one knows about. Things that only a few know about. And Luke here, right at the beginning, is saying, this story is for you. Because here's the message, that Jesus is coming to take away our shame. Jesus doesn't come for the righteous, for those who have it all together, for those who have no shame. He comes for those who know their shame. How does he take it away? Paul writes this verse, I think it's in Corinthians, I'm not sure. He made him who knew no sin to be sin, so that you and I might become the righteousness of God. Now I want to do something. I want to change a word. He made him who knew no shame. Jesus knew no shame. To be shame for us. The cross, crucifixion, was designed for maximum shame. It's not like the death penalty today, where it's done in a closed space where only a couple people might see it. It was done in the most public of places, in the most public of ways, Jesus is crucified on Mount Calvary, lifted up in a place where everybody could see. And people would come and they would mock. And they would ridicule. And they would spit. And almost all of our paintings and sculptures, Jesus has some kind of clothing on. But the reality was, when you were crucified completely naked. It's designed for maximum shame. And what the Gospels teach us, what the Apostles teach us, is that what happened was God took your shame and my shame, and he gave it to Jesus. And he died ashamed with our shame so that you might not. So who's the gospel story for? Who is Luke for? Here in the very beginning of the story of Jesus, we already see Luke saying it's for doubters. It's for those who know that they're empty and barren, and it's for those who know that they're ashamed. So if that's you, hear this. The gospel of Luke is for you. And here's my challenge for you. Read it. Today. There are 24 chapters in the Gospel of Luke. If you just take one a day, you can easily read it in this month. Read it. Ask yourself, is it true? Ask yourself, who did Jesus come for? Did he really come for the barren and the empty? Ask yourself, did Jesus really die to take away my shame? Take those questions to it. Read it. Don't just sit here and hear this. Take it home. Read it for yourself so that you can see that Jesus came to give you certainty, assurance in your doubts, to give you fullness where you have emptiness, and to give you acceptance where you have shame. Amen. Take your bulletins with me. Our prayer is a corporate prayer. It's printed on page 8 of your bulletin. It is...